Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. As we near another season, the sport's all-time hits leader remains banned from baseball and its Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. It's a stark problem in America's pastime. Some of its greatest players, including its home run champion Barry Bonds and other bashers from the steroid era, have an uneasy relationship with the sport and a worse one with fans, media, and the record book. But Pete Rose's situation is different. His banishment has dragged on for more than two decades, and no one doubts the brilliance of his performance on the field. In his new book, Pete Rose, An American Dilemma, Sports Illustrated editor Costa Kennedy shows Rose in all his complications, needy but defiant, demanding but softening in his 70s. We previously spoke with Kennedy about Joe DiMaggio, and it's my pleasure to welcome him back to the Roundtable. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be back with you.
Why do you call this an American dilemma?
Well, the American part, I think, is because he is, this is truly an American life in so many ways. The sort of classic story of, you know, work hard, make good. He is a kid who grew up in a very blue-collar neighborhood in Ohio, which is, as we know, a swing state, a very American place in Cincinnati. And his whole story of making himself who he made himself through hard work and through determination is very real and plays right into sort of American ideals. And then there's this sort of the largeness of his life, of his great success and becoming the all-time hits leader, and, of course, the largest of his fall. And the last thing, I mean, doesn't an American story have to end in Vegas, right? And that's where Pete Rose is these days. It's a dilemma on many fronts. I guess the biggest one is, what do we do with Pete Rose? What do we make of him in terms of history? Is he worthy of the Hall of Fame? Is he not? The sort of the few athletes or figures of that stature, is there such a clear question about, and you have so many people on either side of that. So there's a real dilemma around how we view Pete, as well as there's just infinite number of contradictions within the man himself that sort of play into that dilemma kind of feel. So that's really how the subtitle came to be.
Well, we'll get back to some of those larger questions in a minute. But first, for people who maybe haven't thought about the facts of the case in quite a while, it has been, you know, more than two decades. Remind us how he eventually fell from grace and found himself on the outside looking in.
Absolutely. So he had wrapped up his playing career in 1986 and went on to manage the Cincinnati Reds, that being his hometown team where he was from and where he spent most of his career. And during this time, while he had bet while he was playing, he began to bet very heavily on baseball as a manager, and really began owing a lot of money to people and was mixed in with a lot of people you wouldn't want anybody to be mixed in, let alone a baseball manager. And through an investigation commissioned by baseball and led by an investigator named John Dowd, it was shown, you know, unequivocally, although Pete would deny it for years and years, that he had in fact bet and bet heavily and bet regularly on the Reds. In connection with that, in the summer of 1989, he was banned from Major League Baseball. He was put on what's called a permanently ineligible list by Bart Giamatti, the then commissioner. At this point, Pete was just as eligible to be elected into the Hall of Fame as anybody else. It was only in 1991, about 2 years later, and just as Rose's eligibility was about to come up, that the Hall of Fame got together. They were very concerned, you know, they didn't want Pete in, and some writers had said, well, of course we're going to vote for him because of how great he was on the field and what he meant for the game as a player. Other writers said, absolutely not. His gambling means I would never vote for him. But these writers who make up the voting block for the Hall of Fame were divided, and the Hall of Fame, as well as Major League Baseball itself, which is separate from the Hall of Fame but closely intertwined, was not comfortable with the idea that Pete might get in. So they got together in a hotel room in Manhattan in 1991, and they passed a resolution saying that any player who is on baseball's permanently ineligible list will no longer be eligible for the Hall of Fame. And they passed that very easily, and therefore Pete was not allowed to ever come to vote. And that he's the only player ever to be barred in that way. The one famous player who is also on this permanently ineligible list is Shoeless Joe Jackson of the old White Sox in 1919. But for throughout history, for the first 55 years or so of the Hall of Fame, Shoeless Joe Jackson was eligible to be elected in at any point. He just simply wasn't. And Pete never got that chance. We don't know that he would have been elected to the Hall of Fame. The writers might have said, no way, we're not putting him in, or he just might not have gotten enough vote. But he was deprived of the opportunity to be heard.
Gambling being the common thread between those two. You report now for the first time in this book that there was a deal on the table if Rose would take it, and maybe he could have avoided, you know, the long banishment from baseball and be involved in the game today, even in some fashion.
Yeah, that was something that was really an amazing find for me. Baseball, when they first started on this Pete Rose thing, remember, they loved him. He was so good for the game. He was not only a great player, he loves baseball in a way that I can't think of any other star who so demonstratively knows the game, cares about the game, talks about the game. He was this great ambassador for the sport. They would have liked nothing better than to have Pete stay in the fold. So as this was going on and as it was realized just what they had on Pete, John Dowd, who I mentioned was the lead investigator, what he wished he could have done was taken Pete aside, because Pete was sort of insulated by this team of lawyers and advisors and all of these things. So he never really, you know, got the facts straight, or at least that was baseball's fear. Everything that Dowd came up with, they handed straight over to Rose's team. But Rose's team kept saying, oh, this isn't strong enough, they don't have this. So what Dowd wanted to do was to take Pete aside, away from everybody. He had this idea he would take him up to Cape Cod, where Dowd had a house, and they would walk on the beach in their bathing suits, so, you know, no suspicion of there being a tape recorder or a camera, anything like that. And Dowd could have just said, Pete, look, this is what we have, man. We know that you've done this. I just had lots of people. It all corroborates. And if Pete had finally owned up and said, all right, baseball might have been able to offer him a safe harbor, meaning he would have certainly had to be suspended and serve some punishment. But baseball could have helped him get rid of some of this heavy debt that he had accumulated and help him, maybe he'd have a program to talk to kids or whatever about gambling. The details weren't worked out because it didn't get far enough. But the idea was to help, they could have helped Pete, you know, do some of these things and get back in the game after maybe a year or whatever. You know, and if he'd done that, he could maybe still be managing the Cincinnati Reds right now.
Instead, he maintains his innocence for a long time. About 10 years ago now, he finally came out with the tell-all, or tell-some, depending on how you look at it, memoir, My Prison Without Bars. And what was his gambit then, after kind of reversing course, trying to open up a dialogue with the commissioner, who's now a different person, Commissioner Giamatti, who had originally passed down the punishment, is unfortunately has died, and Bud Selig is now the commissioner for quite a while. We're talking like 2003, 2004. What was his play then?
Well, his big play was to sell a book. You know, he came out with a book, oh, I'm going to admit it. And that was his thing. But it was also to try to be a step towards getting himself back into, this was just 2 years before, after certain bylaws, his expiration on the Hall of Fame ballot would have expired. That would have been 2006. So there was sort of a hope that maybe he could get himself back in. But as you smartly point out, it was a tell some book. He basically admitted to just what he sort of had to admit. He still made fun of Dowd and said he had all this wrong, when really, I mean, this Dowd got maybe some dates and a few details wrong, but this is a locked-up case. I mean, there's no question about it. It was a terrific piece of work. Pete just, you know, he just wanted to try to rehabilitate his image a little bit, sell some books, and take another step in his journey was really the whole thing. He thought that this might be a way to get him back in, if he came clean. And he did before this book came out, about a year before, he went and told Bud Selig that he had bet on baseball and he was going to say this in a book to also try to give him heads-up notice. But I will just say, you know, the Dowd report was, most of it anyway, was public, had been public for years, right from the beginning, basically. And, I mean, anybody who didn't know that Pete or believed that Pete had bet on baseball when his book came out just simply hadn't read the Dowd report. I mean, I understand people don't have time to do that, but there's no way you could read it for even a few minutes and have any question about it whatsoever. It would have to have assumed such a level of conspiracy, it would have been impossible. So that was Pete's attempt, and it didn't really work because people were unhappy with the timing of the book. It came out right near the Hall of Fame induction and with his motivation.
Yeah, we have Cooperstown here in our listening area, and it's very common to see Pete Rose during that weekend, you know, in town selling his autograph and so on. And certainly I think that's only added to the perception of him as being kind of opportunistic. But I wanted to ask you where you think the negotiations, if there are any, stand today. I mean, is he any closer to being let back into baseball than he was 10 years ago?
Well, I can't say that you would call it negotiation. The commissioner has, over the years, listened to people who've come to him about Pete, notably Mike Schmidt and Joe Morgan, former teammates of Pete. Lately, there hasn't been any active listening to anything, although there are people in the game, including with the Reds, who have been kind of leaning on Selig to maybe do something. The commissioner is scheduled to leave after this season. Maybe it's a pardon at the end or something like that. Conversely, if a new commissioner comes in, the Cincinnati Reds have the All-Star game in 2015. It could be a kind of a splash made by the new commissioner coming in. But this is a big leap, Ian, because to put him back into baseball, that's one thing, and to make him eligible for the Hall of Fame, unfortunately, is another thing. So there are really two issues at stake, and, I mean, the Hall of Fame could vote to put him back on the ballot whenever it wants and do so immediately. Getting him back in the game is a road to hoe, and we'll see whether, I'm not 100% sure whether it should happen, and we'll see whether it will.
He's not getting any younger. He's 72 years old, I think.
Yeah, he'll be 73 April 14th of this year, and he's well aware of what time it is in his life, and he's, you know, I really, in the time I spent with him and around him, I noticed there's a sense of remorse in Pete, and I don't think that he feels sorry in the sense of sorry what he did to you and me, or meaning the general baseball fan, or even sorry for what he did to his teammates or his family and all these people that he lied to so brazenly. I don't sense any contrition there, but I think that he is sorry for what he has done to his own life. He's realizing as he looks around, he's been out of the game for 25 years. And, I mean, you know, he could have been any kind of hero. He was so beloved, and he could have so easily taken this a different way, and he messed it up. And I think for the first time in his life, he's really aware, man, I messed this up. And the least of which is not that the money he might have made as a manager and a broadcast and all that. I mean, I'm sure I know he feels sorry to have lost that. But just in general, the whole predicament, I think he understands he's to blame for it. And at the age he's at and where he's at in his life, he does feel regretful.
I was thinking about Pete Rose, trying to look through the lens of Pete Rose at some of the other kind of major Hall of Fame questions we have right now. You know, you think about people like Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, Barry Bonds, who meant so much to the game for a brief period and then have really fallen into disrepute in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like there's an easy answer here, because if you're Pete Rose or, let's say, Mark McGwire, and you admit the charges, so to speak, against you right up front, for a lot of people, that's disqualifying on the spot. If you keep it a secret or you deny it for 5, 10, 15 years and then come clean, people are just as mad.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. You know, when you say disqualifying, I mean, I think that in terms of the whole Hall of Fame debate, that's true. But if you look at someone like McGwire, who's been a hitting coach for 3 years with the Cardinals and now is about to be for a second year with the Dodgers. You look at a player like Jason Giambi, who I think it was 2005 or when the Balco hearings were, admitted to having done steroids and came clean kind of in the public and admitted under oath and transformed himself, apologized. He's 43 years old, and he's probably still going to win a bench job in Cleveland this year. People, they will forgive. It might still, as you say, quote-unquote disqualify someone in the eyes of certain Hall of Fame voters, but in the perception, in public perception, and in your ability to rehabilitate yourself in the game and in people's eyes, coming forward and saying, being contrite and admitting what you've done, there's no question that that's helped players far more than players who have denied it and tried to cover up what people know to be true.
I want to ask you a little bit about Pete Rose's family here. He had has a very complicated relationship with family members, from his son to his siblings. What accounts for that?
Pete, it's really, really difficult for Pete to get intimate with anyone. I mean, there's only so close you can get to him. Sparky Anderson, who was in many ways almost like a dad to Pete, because Pete's father, Harry, who Pete absolutely loved and relied on, died in 1970, which is right when Sparky was taking over the Reds. Sparky said, you know, nobody can ever know him completely. Can't know him. And there's a distance that he doesn't get that close, and it's been very hard on specifically his son, Pete Rose Jr., who's just a wonderful guy who's he's managing now in Class A and has been played minor league baseball for 21 years, an absolutely astounding number of years, and who loves his dad and swears by his dad, but has clearly been let down and would have rather had a much more close and intimate relationship with him. The same is true of his Pete's brother, Dave, who grew up with Pete, of course, down in Anderson Ferry outside Cincinnati. And Dave lives in Indianapolis now, and Pete had a little reality series last year called Pete Rose Hits and Misses, and you'd watch that, and you would have just thought he was an only child. I mean, there's no mention of his brother and two sisters, one of whom has passed away. Dave also very supportive of Pete, really loves him and supports him, but feels, you know, he can go forever without hearing back from him, and craves his attention. These are two figures, Pete Rose Jr. and David Rose, whose own lives are completely defined by their relationship with their father or their brother, by their relationship to Pete Rose. So it's pretty powerful stuff, and it's kind of an amazing relationship to see when you get in close to it.
How do you think this story will end?
Oh, it's a good question. You know, I think that it's hard for me to imagine that rationality won't at some point take over and at least have Rose have a chance to be voted on. I'm not an advocate necessarily for him to get into the Hall of Fame or him not to, but I do think that will happen at some point. And I think that Pete is going to go on being Pete. Whatever happens, as he says, you know, I get up every day and I do Pete Rose. And what that consists of now is mainly signing autographs at a store in Vegas, about 15 days a month, doing various functions. He still comes to Cincinnati and is very much in demand. I think he'll go on doing that, and we'll see whether there's any change with the new commissioner. But where it all ends is going to depend on a lot of factors. I don't see. Pete changing in any way beyond where he has really at this point.
Well, the book is Pete Rose, An American Dilemma. We've been speaking with Kasha Kennedy, who is a editor of Sports Illustrated, and the book is out now from Sports Illustrated Books. Just a really fascinating American life, as you say, and I thank you for spending a few minutes with us.
My pleasure. It's great being on with you, Ian.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.